Today is Friday, December 18th, and you are listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. I am Chinedu Ofo in Washington, sitting in for Jason Patinkin. Coming up, we look at the challenges of getting COVID-19 vaccines in African countries.
The problem is that we don't have time because this is a deadly disease.
Also ahead, today is International Migrants Day.
It's the responsibility of governments to guarantee that all that are present in their own territory, whether they are nationals or non-nationals, have access to vaccines.
Plus, the U.S. may have its first Native American cabinet secretary. These stories and more are next. Our top story today is COVID-19. The European Union will start vaccinations against COVID-19 in less than 10 days as Europe tries to catch up with Britain and the United States. Some have criticized the slower EU approval process for the shots. Soraya Ali of Reuters reports.
States across the European Union will begin COVID-19 vaccinations in a matter of days, starting on December 27th. It comes as Europe tries to catch up with Britain and the United States in what some have criticized as a slow EU approval process. The start date will be almost 3 weeks after the shot was administered in England. Britain, which left the EU early this year, approved the shot for emergency use on December 3rd, followed by Canada on December 9th and the US Food and Drug Administration on December 11th. The world's first fully tested COVID-19 vaccination was developed by Germany's BioNTech and US company Pfizer. As a member of the EU, Germany is obliged to wait for the European Medicines Agency to approve the vaccine. On Thursday, German Health Minister Jens Spahn said Germany will start on December 27th if the approval comes as planned, before an online meeting with Chancellor Angela Merkel and executives from vaccine maker BioNTech. Italy and Austria also said they would start vaccinating on December 27th, the Sunday after Christmas.
Thanks to Soraya Ali of Reuters for that report. The largest COVID-19 outbreak remains in the U.S. with nearly 310,000 deaths, according to Johns Hopkins University. The U.S. has reported over 216,000 COVID-19 cases and over 2,600 deaths a day over the past week, both record averages. Among the recent deaths, 8 Roman Catholic nuns at a retirement home for sisters in the suburbs of the Midwestern city of Milwaukee. The school's Sisters of Notre Dame Central Pacific Province said 4 of those deaths happened Monday alone. The outbreak comes months after 6 other nuns at a nearby convent died of the coronavirus in less than a month. As the death toll rises, the U.S. is expanding its rollout of the newly approved Pfizer-BioNTech COVID-19 vaccine to hundreds of distribution centers. Thousands of healthcare workers are expected to be vaccinated. More from VOA's Mariama Diallo.
Nearly 1,000 doses of the Pfizer-BioNTech COVID-19 vaccine have arrived at Indiana University Health Methodist Hospital in Indianapolis. Hospital Pharmacy Director Tay Trujillo.
It's exciting. This is a light at the end of the tunnel.
But getting people vaccinated is challenging, says Trujillo.
In the environment that we're in right now, with COVID surge, increased patient volumes, staff being tired, and then saying, oh, by the way, we need to add this on. That's the challenge. Everyone's plate is very full, and then we need to make sure this happens and it happens correctly. And with the Pfizer product having a very limited room temperature duration, the timing is kind of crucial.
First 60 doses.
Dr. Stephen Rumpf was one of the first at the hospital to get inoculated.
It has been a long 9 months, is what it's been. It's been a privilege and an honor to be on the front line and take care of people.
COVID-19 has killed more than 310,000 people in the United States and infected more than 17 million, overwhelming the healthcare system, inflicting economic pain, and putting millions out of work. The vaccine is the first step toward recovery, say medical experts. Dr. Bill Petrie, infectious diseases professor at University of Virginia.
We're really so thrilled with how effective this vaccine is and how safe it is. And I think as we get more and more Americans immunized, more and more people around the world immunized, that's what's going to break the back of the pandemic.
But there have been a few cases of allergic reactions to the vaccine, including some in Britain and one Thursday in Alaska.
The vaccine itself will expire.
There are also difficulties involved in distributing the vaccine in remote areas worldwide because of the need to keep the doses in ultra-cold temperatures. Dr. Burak Kazaz, a supply chain expert, explains.
If you're going to a metropolitan city in, say, in Africa, the type of logistical arrangement that we make for the U.S. market is no different. However, for remote places, that might be quite challenging, and we might have to use, for example, drone technologies to deliver in such short periods of time these vaccines.
Meanwhile, on Thursday, the number of cases worldwide has exceeded 74.6 million, according to a tally by Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore. Mariama Diallo, VOA News.
Now let's look at COVID-19 vaccines for Africa. How prepared are most African nations to distribute the COVID-19 vaccines to their communities once they become available? To find out, I spoke with Dr. Anthony Ibe, Assistant Professor of Medicine at Howard University and Georgetown School of Medicine in Washington, D.C., about fears of an infrastructural deficiency that may hamper getting the shots into the arms of Africa's population.
It is a legitimate fear, therefore, that the vaccines will be rolled out in the developed world or Western world, and before it gets to us, it will take some time. But I know that some people have come up with a global initiative like the COVID-19 Vaccine Global Access Initiative, which is a joint venture by the World Health Organization, the Coalition for Epidemic Preparedness, Innovations, and Gavi, to try and make sure Africa is at the center during this rollout. But the real issue also, we all know that infrastructure is a problem, big problem in Africa, most of the places, maybe apart from South Africa. If you are talking about the Pfizer vaccine, and you're talking about storing at minus 80 degrees Fahrenheit, that is untenable in most African countries. Most places we don't have electricity, and wherever we have one is epileptic. The energy should really be spent through organizations like WHO or other voluntary organizations like the Bill Gates Foundation and all that to help us produce the freeze-dried vaccines as soon as possible so that we can get it to our people in all the corners of Africa, irrespective of the infrastructure challenges. And the other challenge about the infrastructure, apart from electricity, is also the fact that the roads, you have to get to some of those places. But I know in the past we've tried to use things like motorcycles, bicycles, carry distance to those places. We can adapt, but these are real challenges.
Yes. What structures do you think should be in place for African nations to be able to better manage the COVID vaccine when it's eventually delivered to Africa?
The problem is that we don't have time because this is a deadly disease. So while we're trying to develop these structures, it may take time. But then if our people are affected by the COVID-19, they're going to die before then. So it would be the structures have to be built up in at the same time. But we have to be looking for other ways to deliver this. You know, like I mentioned, the freeze-dried technology to get some of this vaccine through and other non-conventional ways of sending this to the most remote places.
Should African countries come together as a group and make demands of this unconventional means of getting and preserving the COVID vaccine, or should each country be left on its own?
You know, there's always the saying that the strength in unity, there is strength in numbers. So if we African countries come together under the African Union or West African ECOWAS and all that come together, that would be more powerful because some of the developed areas also do need us in form of trade and all that. So it is also worth their while if they see the pressure coming from these united groups to work with them to deliver these vaccines. Because, okay, let's face it, if you vaccinated all the Western world people, they're not going to live in isolation. a plane flight from anywhere in the world, 10 hours, you're in an African country, and they come to do business, they will be exposed. And Africans are also likely to go to Europe, go to the United States, and if they are vulnerable, they are likely to bring back the infection again. So it is in the global interest, in the interest of all of us, that this vaccination is given to all corners of the world. And that's really what this pandemic has taught us.
How problematic are cultural norms and sometimes religious beliefs in the effort to get people to accept this COVID vaccine?
Definitely these cultural factors, religious, suspicious issues will play a major role in acceptance. Therefore, there's need for messaging. There's need to develop contact with local opinion leaders and take on head on this misinformation.
That's Dr. Anthony Ibe, professor of medicine at Howard University and Georgetown School of Medicine in Washington, D.C., speaking to me earlier. South Korea has reported 1,062 new cases of the coronavirus, its third straight day of over 1,000, as authorities in Seoul warn that hospital beds are in short supply. Seoul City said a COVID-19 patient in his 60s died at his home Tuesday after officials failed to find him a hospital bed for days. The city said an explosive growth in patients this month has resulted in an overload in administrative and medical systems. For today's International Migrants Day, we take a look at how the pandemic has affected migrants. Many migrants have gotten ill, lost jobs, or been stranded as borders close. For more, VOA UN correspondent Margaret Bashir spoke with the head of the UN Migration Agency and filed this report.
There are about 272 million migrants worldwide. A little less than half of them are women. The UN considers a migrant to be anyone who changes their country regardless of the reason, but most move to seek economic improvement. According to the IOM, India has the largest number of migrants living abroad, more than 17 million. The United States remains the top destination country, home to more than 50 million migrants. Some 3 million migrants have been stranded by COVID-19 lockdowns and border closures, but the virus has not stopped the criminals who exploit those seeking to reach new countries. Antonio Vitorino is the director general of the UN's Migration Agency.
There are four times more arrivals in Italy this year through the Mediterranean, one of the most dangerous routes, than last year. Or if you look to the Gulf of Aden, there are 130,000 people who are crossing the Gulf both ways to reach the Gulf countries, and they did not stop because of the pandemic.
More than 3,100 migrants have died trying to reach destination countries this year. Drowning is the most common cause. As some rich nations approve COVID-19 vaccines and begin vaccinating their populations, Vitorino says migrants must not be excluded.
It's the responsibility of governments to guarantee that all that are present in their own territory, whether they are nationals or non-nationals, migrants, irrespective of their legal status, have access to vaccines. Because in practical terms, the pandemic has shown us that nobody is safe until everyone is safe.
International Migrants Day is a time to recognize migrants' contributions to the countries they settle in and respect their right to seek a better life, says the IOM.
Migration is a natural phenomenon of human life. It has always existed, and it will go on existing in our world.
Migrants are often thought of as being undocumented workers, but the vast majority are legally in destination countries. They work in all fields, from manual labor to specialties, including healthcare and technology. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, New York.
This is the Voice of America. More than 300 schoolboys abducted last week by gunmen in northwest Nigeria have been released. Katsina State Governor Aminu Bello Masari made the announcement Thursday on Nigerian State TV, NTA. He said if 344 boarding school students were turned over to security officials and were being brought to the state capital, where they will get physical examinations before being reunited with their families. A bomb attack killed at least 15 civilians, including 11 children, today at a Quran recitation ceremony in central Afghanistan, officials said. At least 20 people were wounded. A provincial official said the explosion happened after a man driving a motorized rickshaw entered the village to sell goods to children and was surrounded by kids. No one immediately claimed responsibility for the attack. Technology giant Alibaba Group Holdings now has facial recognition technology that can identify members of China's Uyghur minority, Surveillance Industry Research IPVM said in a new report. Alibaba said it was dismayed that the unit developed software that can target ethnicity and that the feature was never intended to be released to customers. Human rights group accused China of forcing more than 1 million Muslim Uyghurs into labor camps in Xinjiang region. China denies forcing anyone into what it has called vocational training centers in Xinjiang. You are listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. I am Chinedu Afo in Washington. U.S. President-elect Joe Biden has picked a congresswoman from the southwestern U.S. state of New Mexico to be the first Native American cabinet secretary in U.S. history. It's part of Biden's pledge to assemble the most diverse cabinet in U.S. history. If confirmed by the Senate, Representative Deb Haaland, who hails from the Laguna Pueblo, will lead the U.S. Department of the Interior, which oversees U.S. relations with tribal nations and manages public lands. For more on the historic appointment, my VOA colleague Jason Patinkin in Washington reached out to Native American journalist and activist Julian Brave Noisecat, who is Vice President of Policy and Strategy at the Data for Progress Policy Research Group.
So first of all, Julian, what do you think the reaction has been among Native Americans to Deb Haaland's appointment?
I mean, I think that there's just been so many tears of joy shed over the last 24 hours. You know, this was not a sure victory, but it's one that is so meaningful to First Peoples in this country who have never had a Native cabinet secretary or a Native person at the helm of the Department of Interior.
And why do you think this has struck such a chord? Why are so many, you know, Native people in the U.S. celebrating this appointment?
You know, I think that we see ourselves, our family, our aunties, our mothers in Congresswoman Deb Haaland. And, you know, that she is someone who is really going to fight for us when she's at the helm of Interior. You know, for the last 4 years, we've had fossil fuel executives and lobbyists running that department. And now we're going to have a Laguna Pueblo woman who went to Standing Rock and cooked for the people. And I think that that little anecdote right there tells you that change is coming and that change could be very beautiful. What's important to underline here is that folks like me and tons of other people across Indian country wouldn't have gone and fought for just anyone. But we wanted to lay it all on the line for Congresswoman Haaland to, you know, become a historic first.
I want to explain something really quick for our listeners. You know, in most countries, the interior minister, we don't have ministers, we have secretaries, of course, here, but the interior minister, it's a security position in charge of national police, that sort of thing. But interior secretary is a bit different here in the U.S. Can you explain briefly what the interior department does here and why it matters so much that a Native American person is in charge of that department for the first time?
Absolutely. So the Department of Interior in the United States is in charge of managing public lands and the nation's natural resources. Those lands and resources were, of course, all taken at one point in time from indigenous peoples here in the United States. And the Department of Interior is also responsible for the nation-to-nation relationship with the 574 federally recognized American Indian and Alaskan Native tribal communities across the country. So it's a body of policy work and government bureaucracy that is highly related to lands, resources, and relationships with tribal peoples.
And so let's look at some of the things that will be on Representative Haaland's plate if she is confirmed. One of the big issues, of course, is the pandemic. Native communities have been hit very hard. One of the worst outbreaks in the U.S. was among the Navajo or the Diné people in the Southwest. North and South Dakota have had huge outbreaks, and there are large populations of Lakota and other tribes there. If Holland is confirmed, what will you be expecting her to do, or what will you be holding her account to do to help tribal nations fight off this virus?
So the last administration, the Trump administration, had a very troubling relationship to tribal nations. Of course, the president kept a portrait of Andrew Jackson, the famed Indian killer, over his desk in the White House. His administration worked to open native lands to fossil fuel drilling and leasing. They shrunk protections for sacred sites, national monuments. And all of that was very painful for Indian country. And I think that one of the key first things that the next Secretary of Interior, Deb Haaland, is going to need to do is going to be to restore trust between tribes and the federal government.
Just to follow up a bit on that, what are some of the specific policies that you would like to see her pursue, whether it's related to the pandemic or land issues or other things?
So I think there's a lot of interest in Native communities for what's sometimes called land back. So the return of land to Native governance and control. And there are some places where we are actually actively already doing that. And so I think that that's going to be one of the big things that's going to be pushed for over the next 4 years. Obviously, public lands need to be protected, and they can also play a really crucial role in the fight against climate change. So, you know, that looks like stopping fossil fuel drilling and leasing on those lands, and then at the same time, using that land for renewable and clean energy.
That was Julian Brave-Noisecat speaking to my VOA colleague Jason Patinkin in Washington. Authorities in Fiji say two are dead, including a three-month-old baby, after the powerful cyclone Yasa pounded the Pacific island nation. Brent Wood of Reuters reports.
Authorities in Fiji said on Friday that at least two people have died in the aftermath of cyclone Yasa, including a three-month-old baby. The top Category 5 storm made landfall over the Pacific island nation Thursday evening. Its torrential rains and almost 200-mile-per-hour winds left a trail of destruction and caused widespread flooding. In a video posted on Facebook, Fiji's prime minister said almost 100,000 Fijians were affected, and the island expects hundreds of millions of dollars in damages. Authorities said they were scrambling to help affected communities, but waves more than 10 feet high have prevented rescue missions from reaching the more vulnerable islands in the north. Scores of houses have been destroyed, while power was cut to some areas and roads blocked by fallen trees and flash flooding. Fiji declared a state of natural disaster on Thursday, and a nighttime curfew remains in place, as there are still concerns about heavy rains. Yasa is now a Category 2 storm moving south across the island chain.
That's Brian Wood of Reuters. That's it for our show today. For more in-depth and breaking news 24 hours a day, please visit voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, our colleague Jason Patinkin, and our managing editor Kate Pound Dawson, I am Chinedu Ofor, broadcasting from Washington. Thank you for listening. Have a great weekend.
VOA's Our Voices television program is about more than just sitting and talking about women's issues. It's about listening to them and bringing their opinions to the table and making sure that their voices are heard. Because our lived experiences, our stories, and our voices will help shape the next generation.
Check your local TV listings and join the conversation each week with Our Voices on VOA.
Hi, this is Lori London. Tune in to the Voice of America's newscast. Every hour on the top of each hour, 24/7. Listen to our news and correspondent reports from around the world. VOA is your trusted source.